What do you see on the horizon for financial markets? From uncertainty to opportunity, PGIM can help you rise to the challenges of today, when disciplined risk management is needed most. With $1.2 trillion in AUM and deep expertise across asset classes, our investments shape tomorrow, today. Pursue your tomorrow with PGIM, a leading global asset manager.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
Put knowledge to work and grow your business with CIT. From transportation to healthcare to manufacturing, CIT offers commercial lending, leasing, and treasury management services for small and middle market businesses. Learn more at CIT.com. Put knowledge to work.
Welcome to another episode of the Odd Lots podcast. I'm Tracy Alloway, executive editor of Bloomberg Markets. And unfortunately, my normal co-host, Joe Weisenthal, is away this week. He is off globe-trotting to some very exotic locations on a business trip for Bloomberg. So I thought, as a sort of protest episode, that Joe gets to go on an amazing trip to some very nice places with very good food and very luxurious scenery, we are going to talk about globalization. And specifically, we are going to talk about the negative aspects of globalization. And here with me today as a replacement co-host is Sid Verma. He is one of the newest members of the Bloomberg Markets team. Say hello, Sid.
Hi there.
So, Sid, you are actually the perfect person to talk about this because you've done an enormous amount of work on globalization and cross-border capital flows and development over the course of your career, right?
Yes. For the last couple of years, I've written quite a lot about the opportunities and challenges brought by unfettered capital flows and the backlash against some trade policies that have been implemented at the behest of Western-backed institutions. So, I'm really excited to have this conversation. It seems like it really is the sexy topic of the moment. We've obviously got Brexit vote, the rise of Donald Trump this year, declining trade flows, rising income inequality, political populism. It all seems to nurture a growing view that globalization isn't just out of fashion, it's on life support.
And our guest today, I actually really like the way you described him earlier. It's Danny Roderick. He's an economist. He's also a professor of international political economy at Harvard. And you kind of said he was the original guy who started writing about all the negative aspects of globalization before it was cool, right?
Yeah, he refused to join in the congratulatory party 2 decades ago. And he argued that economists probably overstated the benefits of globalization and that policymakers probably risk a backlash if they push ahead with unfettered free trade and capital policies. So he's exactly the right economist to talk to on this topic.
Right. And in retrospect, it seems like the notion that a backlash was coming was very, very prescient, because here we are in 2016 and everyone's talking about the downsides of globalization, unfettered trade deals, rightly or wrongly, I should say. Well, without further ado, Danny Roderick, thank you so much for joining us today.
Nice to be with you. Thank you.
Should we maybe start with this idea of a backlash? To what extent was the criticism that we are seeing now of globalization, to what extent was that inevitable based on what's happened over the past 2 decades and beyond?
I think it was pretty inevitable. I mean, it seemed clear to me that the opposition was going to be building up. I guess I wrote a little monograph a couple of decades ago called "Has Globalization Gone Too Far?" Mm-hmm. And then, it was different kinds of characters that were sort of it was Pat Buchanan, and you know, in Europe it was the truckers protesting and the agriculturalists, and so there were, you know, sort of other kinds of people on the scene, but the general trends were pretty easy to see, and they arose from some basic fundamentals that the kind of overall economic benefits of globalization sort of began to be swamped by a lot of concerns about redistribution, about what was happening to specific communities, about the elites getting sort of uprooted from sort of their national setting, and then the larger gap opening up between the people who controlled the politics and what was happening, and the ordinary people, sort of, you know, decision making moving away from national capitals to weird places like Brussels or Geneva, or sort of multinationals and banks in closed doors. And so historically, of course, this was also not the first time we were seeing this, that we've had an era of high globalization during the gold standard, and it came to a rather abrupt end for many of the same reasons. I don't think we are up quite the same kind of crisis at this point. I think the globalization we have has much firmer foundations than was the case under the gold standard, but I do think we have pushed it further than it can go, either economically actually or politically.
I like the idea that we're not necessarily facing a huge crisis when it comes to a globalization backlash. Can you spell out what exactly makes it different this time compared to, for instance, the end of the gold standard?
Yeah. I mean, I think we're in a much better, you know, despite all the backlash, the fact is that we have much stronger institutions today compared to the 1920s and 1930s, the interwar period, when the gold standard eventually collapsed. We have much stronger governments that are providing much better safety nets. We have global institutions that provide for much greater global cooperation, the World Trade Organization and the IMF, who had nothing like that in the interwar period. And by and large, I think, you know, that people have incorporated the lessons of the rampant protectionism of the 1930s. And I think even the, you know, the populists, the way they talk about trade policy, it's historically speaking, it's a rather measured kind of protectionism. I don't think smooth and holy would be something that even Donald Trump would would bring up as something that he would like to reenact. So I think the intellectual consensus has actually shifted quite a bit. And even though they're a bit more down in dumps than usual, I mean, I think the political forces that push for open markets, you know, big multinationals or banks or the trade elite, they also happen to be much more, they're still politically quite powerful. So I don't see a fundamental breaking down of the system in the way that we saw. But that doesn't mean that we could, you know, seriously mismanage the situation and, in fact, fuel the rise of and the growth of populism that I think, you know, the damage will be not just to globalization. I think the damage will be to our liberal democratic order. I think that's in fact, a much bigger price to pay.
So, Danny, you mentioned the idea that globalization may in some way have been mismanaged. Can you spell out exactly what you mean by that and give us maybe some examples?
I think I timed the transition to the 1990s, where I think we began to push for a model of globalization that I call hyper-globalization, which is where gradually globalization turned into an end for itself rather than being a means to an end. And we saw increasingly governments negotiating deals or undertaking changes in policies that began to constrain what they could do domestically, began to constrain the way that they could address domestic concerns and oversold the benefits of the resulting arrangements and didn't pay a whole lot of attention to the disruption that those things would cause. And I think if there were sort of two concrete things, one was the creation of the World Trade Organization in the 90s, which went significantly beyond any trade agreement that had been negotiated. And what really stands out about the WTO is that it reached significantly beyond borders into deep domestic territory in economic policymaking, sort of with broad set of restrictions on what governments could do in the way of dealing with subsidies in the area of health and safety standards with respect to intellectual property rights. And on the financial side, of course, even though this was not an international agreement, by and large, complete mobility of capital, particularly of short-term financial capital, became effectively the norm through the workings of the European Union and on a broader scale through the OECD. And I think this this new set of understandings from the 1990s, on the one hand, complete mobility of capital as a norm, and trade agreements, being no longer about tariffs and quotas at the border, but increasingly about domestic regulations and how those had to be coordinated and harmonized across countries, I think sort of both made domestic economic policy making much more hostage, left it much more hostage to this sort of, these anonymous forces of globalization, and created this juncture between sort of, the life that the ordinary people were living and their own economic existence and the kind of policymaking that happened at that sort of international sort of globalization or hyper-globalization driven sphere.
We are going to take a quick break for our sponsors.
Put knowledge to work and grow your business with CIT. From transportation to healthcare to manufacturing, CIT offers commercial lending, leasing, and treasury management services for small and middle market businesses. Learn more at CIT.com. Put knowledge to work.
And we're back. Danny, I'm interested in this idea of globalization, hyper-globalization, if you will, going too far. And I always wonder, how did that actually happen? Like, did politicians just wake up one day and realize that there was a lot of opportunity for them personally in creating these sort of supranational structures that they could then have careers in? Or walk us through this, how this actually happened.
It's a combination, as usual, of interests and ideas. Mm. On the one hand, of course, you had very specific interests at work. And so in financial globalization, of course, there were, banks that became bigger and were interested in removing impediments to capital flows and across borders. You had multinationals who wanted to get market access and therefore were interested in reshaping the regulations of different countries so as to remove impediments in terms of their being able to access these markets. So you had definitely interests at play. But there was also, ideas. I mean, sort of the whole, ideational context of how these things happened in the 1990s. Had as its background, of course, sort of the notion that, markets couldn't do much wrong, that that governments, when they intervened, would only sort of muck things around, mm-hmm. and that, sort of that trade liberalization in the 50s and 60s and 70s had been, had produced a booming world economy, and therefore, which by the way is true, but then sort of the misleading conclusion was drawn that therefore this was the most important thing to keep doing. So effectively, a good thing was taken too far, in my view. And third, I would add that on top of sort of the general ideational context and the interests of various actors, I think there was a political failure on the part, particularly, I would say, of the sort of, what in the United States context, we would call sort of liberals or left liberals, and in Europe would be the socialists and the social democrats, a certain abdication of their responsibility, and they bought into that whole story of how sort of, you know, moving on this hyper-globalization agenda either was something that was necessary, that they couldn't do much about it, or, as was the case in many cases, that this is something that they should actually back, that they should support. Mm-hmm. So somewhat surprisingly, some of the most avid supporters of financial globalization were the socialists in France, or the Clinton Democrats in the United States. So I think, you know, sort of the political group that you might have thought would have acted as a break, in fact, it was very much in behind this push towards hyper-globalization. So I think that's is sort of the combination of the forces that brought us to where we are.
So where do we go going forward? The Trans-Pacific Partnership and the Transatlantic Trade Partnership deals look like they don't have sufficient political backing. The IMF has issued, you know, a mea culpa, saying that they have probably overstated the virtues of neoliberalism, which, you know, tends to argue for the wholesale privatization of companies, as well as a modest role for fiscal policy and fully open trade and financial borders. And at the same time, you know, governments and the IMF are more sympathetic to the view that capital controls can shield themselves from volatility of international finance. So, you know, where are we going next? Are there sufficient number of, you know, is there a moral leadership on the international stage to try and craft a new trading model? Or is it just a model through scenario?
Yes. So as I said earlier, I don't think the really bad scenario is one of a very high likelihood where we have a complete collapse of the world economy and globalization, with all the really terrible political ramifications of the type that we saw in the interwar period. But leaving that aside, I think whether we take a relatively good path or a relatively ugly path depends largely on how the mainstream political groups react, and that's both sort of, you know, center right, center left parties, and also the technocratic establishment. Now, I think both of these groups are sort of halfway down the line. I mean, as you say, there has been a sort of mea culpa of sorts on a number of different dimensions. The free mobility of capital, I think sort of the consensus around that has dissipated, and even the IMF is saying, you know, that we need to, accept that there are circumstances under which capital controls might make sense. And there's sort of, you know, wider agreement that, you know, maybe we needed kind of a different models on trade negotiations. But we're not quite there yet. And we see it, for example, in the way that, you know, an institution like the IMF responds to where we are. On the one hand, you have these sort of revisions in its thinking. On the other hand, you have Christine Lagarde coming out and saying that, you know, we need to stay strong on trade, and the only way that we can progress is by signing more trade agreements, and that it's very important that we do that. So I think, you know, the realization hasn't sunk in that the way that you respond to these things is not by, you know, simply doing a better marketing job on the benefits of trade. That's not the issue. The issue is that ordinary people feel that policymaking and the technocratic and policy elites are pursuing a set of interests which is not theirs, and the main constraint that the world economy faces right now is not that it is not sufficiently open, and so you need to sign new trade agreements. The main constraint is that it's lacking the legitimacy in the eyes of the ordinary people that you need to sustain a moderately open economy. And once you realize that the main constraint is legitimacy, not lack of openness, then you have to really start thinking that what we should be doing is not pushing for more trade agreements, but really fundamentally revisiting what we are negotiating when we talk about trade. And we're not there yet.
But Danny, this is where I get confused, because when people talk about reforming trade or better distributing the benefits of free trade, it seems like by doing that, by definition, you almost go into protectionism, right? Because, you know, improving trade for one group is inevitably going to be good from their perspective and perhaps bad for someone else. So how do you make it better without automatically going backwards and entering a sort of protectionist, everyone for themselves game?
Yeah, I think one of the obstacles in thinking creatively and productively about the world of trade is that we have this, you know, we think about sort of trade and what we're doing in trade as if sort of moving in this unidirectional sort of road that goes from, you know, more open trade to less open trade. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, the battle between protectionism and free trade. You know, this may have been the battle that we were fighting in the 50s and 60s and 70s, and that battle has been won, and it's been won by free traders. But really, since the 1990s and since the World Trade Organization, trade negotiations and trade agreements are not about free trade. So what we're really talking about is not protectionism versus free trade. Large part of the TPP is really about talking about regulations, and regulations that are fundamental to running an open economy and a market-based system. The question is, you know, where should those regulations be designed, and what's the role of international agreements or global market forces in shaping those regulations? So should corporations, for example, have access to a completely separate track in the way that they can pursue their interests and impose their own preferences on governments when no other group, NGOs or labor unions or others, have a similar ability? So, of course, I'm talking about the ISDS, the so-called Investor-State Dispute Settlement System, which is part of the Trans-Pacific Partnership and other trade agreements. Are we talking about, now we're talking about, you know, rules with respect to capital flows and capital account regulations and patent and intellectual property rights and, you know, what are appropriate rules in those areas for a country like Vietnam or for a country like Malaysia? And should those be designed by international agreement? And should the main actors who will be, you know, shaping those regulations be banks and large multinational corporations? These are not issues that are helpfully discussed in light of a, you know, sort of protectionism versus free trade kind of a mindset, because they're not about those. And so that's why I don't think the issue is really that of you know, if we don't negotiate TPP or TTIP, that we're necessarily falling into a protectionist hellhole. The issue is, can we have better rules that address issues of fairness, of distributive justice, of equity, in a sense that people want to make sure that the rules and regulations that affect their lives are made democratically in fora that they can actually openly participate in? Are we allowing for democratic deliberation, sufficient democratic deliberation for the determination of such rules? So those are the kinds of issues, and I think they're certainly are the ones that ought to be discussed.
I think that brings us quite neatly onto kind of two separate topics, whether it's trade globalization or financial globalization. But one way of looking at slowing globalization is the fact that trade growth has been weaker than GDP growth in recent years, and that trade elasticity, so-called trade elasticity, is projected to be weak again this year. And I know that you say that that's a very blunt way of looking at, you know, globalization. But it seems that trade volumes are weak, and there seems to be an existential threat for emerging markets in the coming decades, given the fact that there are new manufacturing techniques that could, you know, increase import substitution in developed markets. You know, to what extent are you concerned that emerging markets lack the comparative advantage from new innovative technologies such as driverless cars, 3D printing, and new software? Because traditionally, we know that for emerging markets to grow, they need to build out competitive manufacturing hubs.
Yes. I mean, first, I think the decline of trade volumes in relation to global output in recent years, that I don't think has much to do with the populist backlash so far. So I don't think that's really driven through by the rise of protectionism. There are much, you know, sort of there, you know, supply chains are being sort of brought in home because of technological changes, and the slowing down of China and is also a very big factor in that. So there are, you know, what's happening to trade recently, I think, is largely driven by economic and technological changes and not by the politics around trade. Although I do think that if we mismanage globalization, political risks and political barriers will start to play a role as well. But going back to the question of developing countries and emerging markets, I'm indeed very concerned by the fact that manufacturing is increasingly becoming skill and technology intensive, and effectively comparative advantage in manufacturing is moving away from many low-income countries. And then the traditional route whereby countries developed very rapidly was one of export-oriented industrialization. That's, of course, what China did. Before China, it's what South Korea and Taiwan did. Before them, it was Japan. And what we see around the world these days is that that really a process of what I've called premature deindustrialization in low to middle income countries, mm-hmm. that they are becoming deindustrialized at very low levels of development, and manufacturing isn't serving the kind of escalator role that it did. So, a country like Ethiopia that really is in some sense ideally placed to be the next sort of low-cost source for manufactured exports, has received some Chinese investment, but I really don't see it developing in quite the same way that the East Asian countries did before. And I think technology has a lot to do with it. When we start talking about, 3D printing of shoes, you've suddenly, taken away, one of the main mechanisms through which low-income countries developed. And you've taken that escalator away from them. So it is an issue that I think will mark developing countries in the decades ahead.
And of course, going forward, financial globalization is a big question mark. Obviously we have a dollar-driven global financial order, but there's nothing new under the sun, and you have been warning for years about the risks of boom-bust capital flow cycles. Are you concerned that maybe emerging markets are a bit too cautious to impose capital controls or moderate the pace of credit growth because there's a perception that, open financial markets can boost growth when, that contention isn't necessarily supported wholesale in economic theory?
I am, you're right that there is, on the one hand, there has been an ideological shift, as we talked earlier, that even the IMF is not in favor of complete freedom of capital mobility, understands that developing countries may want to use capital controls. On the other hand, in terms of practice, there is still a certain amount of stigma, a certain amount of risks to policymakers from using capital controls. And I think what...
Could you give us any examples at all?
I'm sorry?
Could you give us any examples at all?
Well, I mean, most, you know, sub-Saharan African countries still maintain maintain fairly open capital accounts. And you know, what they want to be is they want to be, you know, seen as you know, particularly promising frontier market economies. So, you know, we have now this new notion that we're marketing as frontier market economies, and then that's sort of as, you know, as recipients of capital inflows. And it doesn't seem like the right thing to do if you want to be perceived as a frontier economy to actively manage capital flows. So these countries are getting very mixed messages from official institutions and financial markets. And one thing that, you know, the IMF could be doing that it's not doing is actually provide, you know, active technical assistance to how capital accounts ought to be managed. So it's one thing to say that it's, you know, you should do it, maybe as a last resort, but it's okay. But, you know, policymakers in the developing world are really concerned that, you know, they don't know how to do it. They worry that, that you know, it'll be very easy to circumvent controls, that there are not that many good examples around them. So I think that, you know, that it becomes, you know, the relatively less risky thing to do for reputational reasons not to, you know, want to do anything. And I don't think international institutions are necessarily helping them all that much.
We are going to have to leave it there, although I know we could keep talking about all of this for much, much longer. Danny Roderick, thank you so much for joining us today.
It was a pleasure.
So, Sid, that was your debut Oddlots podcast. I feel like we managed to cover quite a lot of ground. Let's see, we talked about hyperglobalization, technocrats, premature deindustrialization. What kind of caught your attention the most?
I think I'm a bit concerned about the policy prescriptions to try and address this big problem, because if you balkanize regulatory and legal policy at national borders, you're effectively increasing the cost of doing business, and you therefore increase costs for goods and services, and that just unleashes bad inflation. I'm just not sure this idea that supranational bodies have just too much control, and therefore we should be responsive to democratic concerns. I mean, I guess I've now realized that I am a authoritarian and I might be more right-wing than I realized.
Yeah, the one thing I wish we'd asked is whether or not Professor Roderick is happy with the fact that all of these issues seem to be getting more attention thanks to the rise of populist parties, people like Donald Trump or the Brexit campaign in the UK, or whether he's concerned about the way in which those discussions are actually happening and whether the way the discussions are unfolding ends up being detrimental for everyone. I don't know.
Yeah, I haven't seen anyone at a Donald Trump rally hold up a sign arguing for control over pharmaceutical pharmaceutical legislation.
Right.
So yes, there is a big disconnect between the populist debates and the policy debates. I also think China is the elephant in the room as well, because, you know, everyone argues that China should liberalize its capital, currency and trade policies, and that can help rebalance its domestic economy and beef up its productivity. And if it does, it could boost global aggregate demand and give globalization a new lease of life. But it seems that, you know, if you are against such liberalization efforts, China should continue maybe with its status quo. And it seems like that could be quite a controversial stance to hold.
I feel like we are going to be talking about all these issues for quite some time to come. But again, we're going to have to leave it there for today. I'm Tracy Alloway. You can follow me on Twitter at Tracy Alloway.
And I'm Sid Verma. You can follow me on Twitter at _SidVerma.
And Danny Roderick is also on Twitter. He is at Roderick Danny. Thanks for listening.
Put knowledge to work and grow your business with CIT. From From transportation to healthcare to manufacturing, CIT offers commercial lending, leasing, and treasury management services for small and middle market businesses. Learn more at CIT.com. Put knowledge to work.
Join us in Chicago or virtually on May 2nd for Bloomberg's Business Value of AI event and networking reception. This event will gather business and technology executives to share their experiences and provide insights into their strategies for deploying AI that achieves a desirable ROI. You'll also learn how companies have successfully implemented AI solutions that have improved productivity and profitability. This program is proudly sponsored by IBM. Register at BloombergLive.com/AI/radio.